Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Right, that's not our usual connection theme. It's George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, composed in 1924. It was supposed to become everyone's property a couple of years back, but it did not. The copyright term extension passed by Congress in 1998 gave the Gershwin estate an extra 20 years of exclusive rights to this tune. And the people who argue for better public access say that's going too far. That's why they took the matter to the Supreme Court yesterday. Now, let's be clear. The question is not who owns Mickey Mouse. Disney owns the squeaky little rodent in shorts pants and always will, because the mouse is trademarked. Today, we're tackling the more debatable question of copyright. It's the constitutional provision that was meant to balance the rights of the artist and the rights of the people. Some claim that stronger and longer copyright laws foster more artistic production. Others say that's corporate nonsense, that real creativity is nourished when books and songs and films belong to the public. So, Connection listeners, how important is the public domain today? And are we, the public, helped or hurt by copyright protections? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, as I said, the case was argued yesterday at the Supreme Court. With us today, lawyers on both sides who were there and can explain why this matters. Edward Lee is a professor of law at Ohio State University College of Law. He was on the team that argued the copyright extension is wrong. He's in our Washington studio. Robert Clarida is a partner with Cowan, Leibowitz and Latman. He's with the team that was arguing in favor of the copyright extension. He joins us from our studio in New York. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks a lot, Dick.
Edward Lee, let me ask you to start, and Robert follow right behind, because what I'd like to get from both of you is a sense of what happened at the Supreme Court yesterday. I know that when you listen to the questions that the justices ask and the areas that they probe, you can get a sense of how they're regarding this issue. So you watched the game. What do you think that we can interpret from that? Edward Lee, do you want to start?
Sure, Dick. I think that it was an excellent oral argument. To the extent that I could be sort of an impartial observer, it was just a delight to watch the argument unfold. I thought the court asked intensive questions to both sides and seemed to sort of probe weaknesses that they thought in the argument, and were asking fair but hard questions to both sides. And I think one thing that is clear to me is that, putting aside whether the court ultimately holds that the Sonny Bono Act is unconstitutional, the court takes the problem very seriously, that there is a problem with extending copyright terms. And it is actually totally against what Jack Valenti had predicted, that the case was essentially allowing the court to have some fun. I don't think this is anything about the court having fun. I think this is actually the court considers this issue about copyright extensions a very serious issue and a serious one for them to consider.
Just a couple of quick clarifications before we go to Bob, and that is that the name of the act under consideration is the Sonny Bono copyright term extension, named after him because he was one of the artists who thought that copyright should last in perpetuity. And it was given his name shortly after his death, Jack Valenti, the man who we all know speaks on behalf of the motion picture industry. Okay, so Robert, were you watching the same game that Edwards just described?
Yes, I would agree with virtually everything Ed just said. I think the justices clearly do take this issue very seriously, and it was not a day in the park for them, certainly, nor for either of the attorneys arguing. I think everybody got some very tough questions and some very well-reasoned arguments that were implied by the questions. There were tips of some very interesting icebergs there. But I also think that any petitioner in Mr. Eldred's position trying to overturn an act of Congress has a real uphill battle in doing it. Acts of Congress are presumed constitutional, and the standard for getting them thrown out is very high. And particularly when the petitioner has lost at the two previous levels, I think they walk into the Supreme Court with a real job to do. And I think that's certainly the way things stand today. Nothing I heard in the argument yesterday suggests to me that that uphill battle has been won by any stretch of the imagination.
Let's, if we can, split this into two pieces. The first that you're just talking about, Bob, and that is the whether or not Congress has the right to impose these limits. And the second, the whole issue of public domain and who benefits as that suggested. On the first one, this issue of whether or not Congress is doing its job by extending the limit on copyright. Edward, what's the argument against that? To help me out with this, your understanding of what was intended, what the word limit's supposed to mean.
Well, it's interesting that there was one point in the oral argument yesterday that Justice O'Connor actually said that what has been going on with these extending the terms that have already for existing copyrights flies in the face of what the framers intended. And meaning that basically the framers had this intention of granting copyrights that had a relatively short duration. Back then, there was a maximum of 28 years under the first Copyright Act, and that eventually that work would fall into the public domain. And our main argument is essentially that the words limited times in the Constitution is a restriction that should be enforced. It should be given meaning. And we've pressed the government to come up with a limit under its interpretation of the Constitution, and to this date it still hasn't really proposed.
But they have they not? I mean, every time there is an extension, it is a finite extension. It might be 95 years, but it is at least a limit.
It is a limit, but the power to keep on extending terms gives you, in effect, the functional equivalent of a perpetual copyright. So Congress can keep on extending the term in the year 2019, when the some of these works would fall into the public domain, and so forth. And there's one point in the oral argument yesterday when Solicitor General Olson actually conceded that a limit would be a perpetual copyright or their functional equivalent. And then when pressed by Justice Scalia, he backed down from that. But that's precisely what we're arguing, that you cannot allow Congress to keep on extending terms if you actually want to have a limit that has any meaning.
How do you do it, though, Bob Clarida? How do you get inside the head of the framers to try and figure out exactly what it was they intended with the words of that article in the Constitution?
Well, I've never been sure how the court approaches that job. Certainly what they do is very often this court will look to dictionary definitions, and particularly, as odd it may seem to some listeners, dictionary definitions that were contemporary with the drafting of the Constitution. What did the word mean at that time to the people who were drafting that document? So that's one way they go about doing it. And if you look in the dictionary definitions that were offered by both parties in the case, you find things like fixed, finite, definite, certain. You don't find anything about it being immutable or inalterable. And so the government's argument, and I think it's a very good interpretation of the plain meaning of the word limited, is for a finite time. And as you pointed out, it really has always been the case that every extension of term is for a finite limited term. Now, I think Ed's point is that if Congress can continually add a new finite term to the existing finite term, then there is, in effect, no limit. But Justice Breyer, very early in the argument, asked the petitioner, well, doesn't that mean that the 1976 Act would also be unconstitutional? Every copyright extension that has ever been since 1790 would also be unconstitutional. And Professor Lessig, arguing for the petitioner, candidly said, yes, that's what it would mean. And Justice Breyer said, well, I think maybe we need to find a new theory. And that was the closest there came to a punchline in the argument.
Of course, it gets much more complicated by the fact that since the 1700s, there are now photocopy machines and cassettes and the Internet and a whole bunch of different ways that people can take advantage of other people's material. And I'd like to just sort of step aside from that legal point for a minute to move to the bigger philosophical question.
Could I just add one point to that?
I'd ask you to be brief, Counselor.
Okay. The key issue is what the Constitution means, and the previous acts are basically irrelevant to interpreting the Constitution, except for the very first Copyright Act, the Act of 1790, which did not extend the terms of existing copyrights. That was the only contemporaneous copyright statute that was around at the time of the framers, and some of the framers were part of the Congress that enacted that law. So that's the key issue, not whether these other copyright statutes later on in history actually extended the terms.
Okay, let's go to the nub of this, though, and that is the whole question about public domain and whether or not it was the intention of the people who originally devised the idea of copyright to protect the interests of the artist, or protect the interests of the public. Is it a balancing act that changes year to year, decade to decade? Bob Clarida, do you want to start?
Well, I think certainly it does change year to year and decade to decade, and I think the framers saw that it might very well change, and that's why they didn't put a finite number in and say the copyright term shall be 14 years. They left it to Congress to make that decision. So certainly technological circumstances, economic circumstances, demographic circumstances can change and can alter the balance that is optimal for society, and it's up to Congress to find what that balance is. And they're always juggling two vital policies here. In an ideal world, we would have free immediate access to every work ever written for everyone in the world, and we would have generous rewards and incentives to creators. But we can't have an unlimited supply of both of those things, and it's up to Congress to sort of draw a line and say, all right, we're going to have this much access and this much reward.
Edward, you are a student of public domain. You're writing a piece on it right now, I understand. Does public domain, does that principle change?
Well, I think there's a basic core principle that does not change for the public domain. And if you go back to the development historically of this concept, there was an 1896 case when the Supreme Court used the term that for an expired patent, that the invention fell into the domain of things public. And that goes back to the Roman Republic notion that there were certain public things that were sort of thought to be sort of like publicly owned goods, and that under the Roman Republic days, citizens had a right of access to certain basic necessities of life, such as water, air, and the roads. Now, when the framers recognized the concept of the public domain in the context of copyright law, what they were in effect saying was that we consider the entry of works into the public domain and giving the public rights of access to those works eventually is a basic necessity for what we consider to be our society.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, yesterday the copyright term extension was argued at the Supreme Court. We have lawyers from both sides of that argument on the program today. In fact, we're listening to a Duke Ellington tune in the background. This is East St. Louis Toodaloo, composed in 1927. If you want to just try and fix how this whole copyright thing is or might be affecting you, under the old rules, this tune would have come into the public domain in a couple of months' time. As it stands, it'll be a couple of months and 20 years' time due to the Sonny Bono copyright term extension. And the question that we're asking you to consider and join us in our conversation on is whether or not that benefits the artist, benefits the arts, or whether or not it's something that actually restricts the public access to that type of material. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University,
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Nick Lowe wrote this song, and Elvis Costello originally made it a hit with this version. Curtis Stigers covered the song for the Bodyguard soundtrack. Yes, that wonderful Whitney Houston film. But the soundtrack sold millions of copies, and because Nick still owned the copyright to the song that he wrote, he made a great pile of money that he has used in the intervening years to bankroll his subsequent albums. Now, it has allowed him to create new original music on his own terms without taking orders from someone else. And allowed him to give songs to the world that might not have existed otherwise. Classic example of the premise of copyright revenues funding new works. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. The whole issue of copyright, public domain, was before the Supreme Court yesterday in the Eldred versus Ashcroft, the argument over the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. With us on the program, Robert Clarida, partner with Cowan, Leibowitz, and Latman. He's with the team that was arguing in favor of the copyright extension. Edward Lee's with us. He's a professor of law at Ohio State University College of Law, and he was with those arguing that the copyright extension is wrong. Now, Robert, I wanted to speak to you briefly about the act, but just to clarify before we go there, Edward, on behalf of the plaintiff, you're saying that the life of the artist, plus 70 years on top of that, is too long. That's too much copyright extension. What's about right? What would you say is proper?
Well, Dick, actually, that's not exactly our argument. We're not contesting the length of the term that the Congress sets. We
right.
believe there's discretion for Congress to actually set life of the author plus 50 versus life of the author plus 70. What we do contest is Congress's ability to actually go back and give extended terms to copyrights that already exist on the basis that basically this is not promoting the progress of science as the framers envisioned it, and it's not a limited time when you keep on having the ability to extend an existing copyright.
So the law that was in place at the time when the work was produced is the law that ought to apply to the copyright for that work. Is that accurate?
Exactly.
What do you think about that, Robert?
Well, I think there are all sorts of reasons for extending all copyrights, extending the term of existing works as well as works going forward. And I think what we have already in the copyright statute in the United States is this incredibly difficult mathematics that you have to do to figure out the term of copyright in a work. And it would just be that much more complicated if you also had to take into account the changes in the statutes that have happened in the intervening years. So you say, well, was it under this statute or that statute? What we now have is a very easily administrable system where you say, if it's a pre-78 work, the term is 95 years after publication, period. And you can say that, and you know, there it is. And that doesn't mean it might be 105 years by the time, you know, the day arrives. But, you know, there is a way of calculating it, and you know what it is, and people can make rational business judgments based on that. And I think there's, you know, copyright is, among other things, very big business, and I think both parties are, you know, mindful of that. And people have to make business decisions based on, you know, the value of these copyrighted assets, and they have to know this is going to last me X number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem of you know, subdividing and saying, okay, this work is going to get an extra 5 years because it was created in year X, is just going to add to the burden of that.
Edward Lee, just a grade four explanation here of what happens to the status of a work when it moves from protection to the public domain.
It's very simple. As soon as it goes into the public domain, any member of the public has an unrestricted right of access to use the work and to do essentially whatever he or she wants to do with the work. So, for instance, if the work falls into the public domain, you could go out and copy it, post it on the internet, distribute it to all your friends. You could perform it for free.
Change it, play with the words.
Exactly. You can make a derivative work from it and create another work entirely. So the whole notion about unrestricted access is that in the public domain, you're essentially free to do what you want with it. And this fosters learning, and it also fosters creativity.
We're joined on the line now by Michael Strunsky. Michael is trustee and executor of the Ira Gershwin Musical Estate and Trusts. Michael, the question of that shift of something from the private to public is something that you're watching very closely.
Sure. Basically, with my business hat on, I'm responsible in a fiduciary way to the beneficiaries of Ira and Leonard Gershwin's estates. And the single largest asset in those estates are Ira's copyrights.
And if someone were to... Well, no, I'll say to you, if I make the argument to you that once Ira has died, that the material should go to the public domain. What's the strongest argument that you make that, in fact, the copyright should extend beyond his lifetime?
Well, when the work was created, the term of copyright at the time was known, and the theory is that that was an asset that that Ira was creating, much as a businessman might create a steel mill as an asset, and he could look forward to the benefit, the results of that creative effort, mm-hmm. to support his family and to probably go two generations to the future.
The same way that I might save money, put it away for my children after my death?
Yes, or invent a marvelous new device that your children would have the rights to, or create a business. Basically, it is a business.
And when you collect the money based on that business, on the copyright of Ira's work, then do you feel an obligation to use that money to foster new work the way that I gather it was meant to be?
Well, I think the fostering of the new work was the economic incentive to Ira. I think the copyright law has done its task because Ira was motivated to be creative. That was a deal, and that deal is done. My job is to continue to maximize the benefits of that for the beneficiaries. Now, in Ira's estate, which is most interesting, the vast majority of those undivided copyright interests are held by two charitable trusts. So those funds go to improve the theater, go towards medical research, and several other charitable causes.
Okay, Edward Lee and Bob Claret, the idea that Michael's just described to us about how it works as an incentive for the artist. Bob, do you want to start on this? Is this the type of argument that you think is most persuasive in saying, and that's why terms should be extended, terms should be protected?
Well, it gets to part of it. I think there are some other really important aspects that need to come out, though. First, the Constitution doesn't speak about an incentive to creation. It talks about progress, and progress is a very broad term. Progress doesn't just mean the creation of new works any more than the progress of civilization is just population growth. I mean, there are other things that happen in order to have progress. And one of those things that's very important is that these works have to get out to the public, and they have to be accessible, and they have to be developed. And so there's an incentive to disseminate and an incentive to distribute these works that's also very important. And another thing that I think is alluded to in a way in the Gershwin example is that works that have been successful for a period of time and continue to be successful can generate revenues that will go toward the creation of new works. Your Nick Lowe example is terrific. He had a tune used in a film soundtrack, and it enables him to do all sorts of other things without having to watch his budget quite so carefully. And if you extrapolate that over time and you say, okay, publisher X, whoever you are that publishes Hemingway, you have all these revenues coming in from your Hemingway works that are not in the public domain and are not about to go in the public domain, you now have revenue that you can use to pay a new author his first advance to write his first novel. And that's money that this publisher has to spur the incentive to create a new work, not a Hemingway work. Certainly the Hemingway work has been created. That deal is done. But the ability of that revenue to generate new works is certainly not done.
Edward, what's the argument for moving this material more quickly into the public domain then?
Well, what's missing from the entire discussion so far is the amount of harm to the public. There's no doubt the copyright holder for certain works can exploit and get more money or royalties from exploiting the work. But on the other side, there is harm, concrete harm to the public. So to take one example, you aired Rhapsody in Blue at the opening of the show.
Right.
That Gershwin song, published in 1924, as you said, should have already fallen to the public domain had not this new law in effect. Now, the practical consequence of this work not going into the public domain is that there are plenty of orchestras, small and medium-sized orchestras around the country, that cannot perform this music because it's simply too expensive to rent the sheet music for that work. It costs hundreds of dollars simply to rent for a one-time performance the sheet music for the orchestra to perform. I have a client out in Colorado, Lawrence Galan, who's the professor of conducting at the University of Denver. He was going to perform this work at an upcoming concert this season. It was an all-American concert for all-American, sort of all-American composers, which is fitting after September 11th. And basically, he's had to forgo performance of this song because it costs too much to rent the music. Now, as you said before, had not Sonny Bono went into effect, it would have been in the public domain. He would have been able to perform it, and the community in Denver would have been able to enjoy it.
All right, let's widen out our conversation here to include Moshe, who's calling in from Boston. Hi, Moshe.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Let me make a few comments, and then I'll get off the air because I'm about to be late for my job. I'm a professional musician specializing in jazz, and a few points that I'd like to make, that the argument that musicians benefit from extension of copyright law are wrong, both in financial terms and in freedom of expression.
Why is that, Moshe? Why do they not benefit?
Okay, the previous speaker mentioned that musicians are greatly restricted from performing copyrighted works simply because the cost is too prohibitive. Let's say I was considering to make a CD of a medley of Gershwin tunes, like 20 or 25 tunes, and I found out it's just too prohibitive to the royalties thing. As a matter of fact, not just my opinion, I remember getting a Michael Feinstein CD of Gershwin medleys, and he had to have some kind of really special deal with copyright holders in order to be afford to issue it. So that's a major issue with all normal musicians. On the other hand, as financial story goes, most of those copyrights end up not in musicians' hands anyway, but in some kind of entities which has nothing to do with musicians, because, you know, like, look at the history of jazz. Most of the musicians sold or even never were offered those copyrights, and it ended up in recording companies. And those extensions, they don't benefit musicians in any way.
Moshe, let me just stop you there if I can and ask Michael Strunsky to join us, because we're talking specifically about, you know, the accessibility or the inaccessibility of the work that's in your charitable trust, Michael.
I'm not sure what your question is, but
You're hearing people say, gosh, I would love to play that Gershwin music, but I can't because it's still under copyright.
Well, like anything else, we run a business, and under the current laws, there is a term of copyright of 95 years. We always try and work closely with performers and artists who would like to play our music and to make some sort of an arrangement with them that makes it affordable for them.
Right.
You must remember, however, that in many of these copyright cases, the incentive is really just a transfer of where the revenue is going to go, whether it comes to the original copyright holders, such as us, or goes to the new. When Quincy Jones was testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee back in the mid-90s on this issue, he held up a Mozart recording and a Gershwin recording that he had bought at Tower Records that morning, and both of them were the same price. So Mozart was in the public domain, Gershwin wasn't. Somebody in the process was obtaining the profit on that. I think my point is fairly clear.
Michael, thanks for being with us on the program. It's nice to have that perspective. Michael Strunsky is trustee and executor of the Ira Gershwin Musical Estate and Trust. Moshe, thanks for your call. Ed, let me just ask you to respond to the point that Moshe was making about this being now more a corporate matter than something that's actually benefiting the artist.
I think that's entirely true. And when Michael says that he's running a business, yeah, there's no doubt that he should be running the business, and it's in his interest to try to continue to maximize the income return on the copyrighted music. But one recurring, I think, theme of the Supreme Court's decisions in the Copyright Clause context is this need for a balance. That the balance is, on the one hand, you want to give a fair return for the creativity of authors. On the other hand, you want the ultimate benefit to go to the public with the widest possible availability of works. And when we see now the continuous extensions, the balance seems not to be there. It seems to be in favor of rewarding more and more the authors and not promoting the widest availability of works, as Moshe's call demonstrated.
Well, we certainly know, though, Bob, that the lobbying effort exists with the corporate effort. Is the point that Ed's making? Do you acknowledge that he's got something there?
Well, I think that was pretty clear in the argument in the court yesterday that a lot of the justices really have a problem with the legislative result, but that doesn't make it unconstitutional. You know, the fact that the legislature made an unwise decision is not something that the court is supposed to look behind as a substantive matter and say, oh, we think they should have done it the other way. It's maybe one of the failings of democracy that some parties are better represented than others. And I think one of the real difficulties that the public domain advocates have is that their interest is not easily monetizable. And the people who are most affected by the shrinkage of the public domain don't tend to take a great role in crafting legislation.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Little music in the background, Old Man River, performance by Jeff Beck and Rod Stewart. It was a song composed in 1927 by Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein. The second would have been public domain also in 2003, but it won't be in the public domain for another 20 or so odd years as a result of the copyright term extension. 1-800-423-8255. Join us for our conversation about the public domain.
He don't plant traitors, and we all know we don't pick cotton, but they're my planner.
From Boston.
You probably remember the nasty legal battle waged by the Margaret Mitchell Estate against Alice Randall, the author of The Wind Done Gone. We're listening to the theme from Gone with the Wind. This is The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Now, recall back, the Mitchell Estate hated the new work that was written, wanted to bar its release. The only angle was to claim copyright infringement. Since the book was still under copyright, it was as a result of post-publication extensions of that term. It was originally published in 1936. The copyright at the time would have lasted until 92, at which point it would have been in the public domain, and you could have written anything you wanted based on the original. Alice Randall, incidentally, eventually won a court case there under First Amendment protection of parody and social commentary based on existing work. But it does, again, once again, refocus that issue over finding the balance between what Robert Clarida quite rightly pointed out is a clearly understandable, monetizable, I think was the word, Robert, that you used, value of that work under copyright to the artist, and that completely subjective way of trying to figure out what the public value is, or what the value to the public of moving that into the public domain. And Edward Lee, if you can put a cash value on one side and not on the other, it's not a very useful playing ground or field to try and determine what's right or what should happen, is it?
Well, I think that shows some of the difficulty of trying to show why this problem affects everyone. And I think that Justice Breyer yesterday, in fact, did say that the cost would be, immeasurable to the public by extending the terms.
Sorry, did you say measurable or immeasurable?
No, immeasurable.
Okay.
It would be immeasurable harm to the public. Now, I think in sort of in place of that, what we can do is bring up these specific examples of artists, musicians, authors who have been impacted in a very negative way by these extensions. And I think Moishe's Call is one example, and the example I brought up earlier is another. But this is going around to hundreds and hundreds of authors out there and artists out there who would like to enjoy public domain works, but the effect of the Sonny Bono law is to put a 20-year moratorium on any new work falling into the public domain. So no new work will fall into the public domain until the year 2018.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Brookline, Massachusetts. Ben's on the line. Hi, Ben.
Howdy. This is a pleasure for me because I've been an artist all my life since the age of four. And as a matter of fact, I had a typeface, which I'm still trying to recover something from, that was lifted by someone for their use, even though I submitted it with the full knowledge that I would benefit from it. And it would take a very great lawyer to get it away from these other people who may very well have slipped a copyright in there. But I'm for the perpetual copyright and the monetization of it rather than this freebie. Ayn Rand is turning over in a grave listening to the left-wing faction of your discussion right now. In the first place, if you had a steel plant that you that your great-grandfather put together and it was still viable as a steel plant, somebody wouldn't say there should be a limit as to when that steel plant is no longer in the family or whoever they turned it over, charitable trust, or just sold it to someone else who has the equal right to perpetuate it.
I guess what it comes down to, Ben, is whether or not there's any difference between the steel plant, the real property, and the intellectual property,
the idea. I see no reason why there should be. That's a mythological thing created by the lust for the public for something for nothing. It's so insidious that I hate to say it, but the fellow with the Russian-speaking voice who was a musician completely fails to understand what he's talking about. If you want a car, you have to afford it. If you want to take a train ride, even on public transportation, you have to afford it. That is a free capitalistic society idea of how to benefit the individuals who are creative, whether they're producing tangible or intangible goods. The notion that there's a difference between tangible and intangible goods is specious all the way at best. Breyer did not say what that gentleman just said he said. He's even misinterpreting it for his own purpose in argumentation. The whole point legally that Breyer's trying to make is immeasurable means that if you have no grounds for measurement, you can't have a law. And that's what Breyer meant. He didn't mean what this gentleman is saying in his
take a minute here, Ben, because I want to hear from Edward Lee on this idea that it's people looking for
something for nothing.
Yeah, they're parasites, right?
Absolutely.
Well, first of all, there's no reason to cast aspersions on the listeners before us who called in. And just to respond specifically to the left-wing attack, Steve Forbes has come out against this law, as well as several very prominent conservative economists like Milton Friedman, who wrote a brief along with several other Nobel Prize winners, basically saying that the law captures 99.8% of a perpetual copyright. So the Sonny Bono Act does act like a functional equivalent of what this caller who just called in actually wants. I believe that this issue is a non-sort of partisan issue that really doesn't draw ideological distinctions. It's basically going back to the Constitution and what the framers had in mind. What they had in mind, and I think it goes back to this ideal of a republic, they had in mind that every citizen in the United States would have an unrestricted access to works after they fell into the public domain. That doesn't mean that the author gets no money at all. Quite to the contrary, for a significant length of time now, the author will recoup a lot of money for the production of his or her work. So,
Ed, make the case to Ben why it's important, though, that material, whether it's typeface or a song or a film script, moves to the public domain. What's the at the nub of that argument?
Well, I think the nub is that basically this is our common culture. We're talking about works that were created in this country for years and years ago, and basically giving the public rights of access to it ensures that this culture remains with us. It doesn't die out. So, for instance, a problem today with film preservation is that for many works, you can't identify the copyright holder. These are called so-called orphan works, and the Library of Congress has said that this is the largest category of works that of film that are deteriorating. And basically, locking them up for 20 more years where there's no ostensible copyright holder means that we will lose these important sound films, silent films, that were made long ago. And, you know, I think that would be a tragedy for this country. You know, we're talking about ensuring access to the public domain helps to preserve our common culture.
Bob, do you want to give us the flip side just of the public domain argument, that idea that... In fact, there's two things going on here. One is the protection of the corporate interests, and the other, protection of the public interest.
Well, sure. I mean, I think ultimately, copyright, even in the serving, you know, to put money in corporate pockets, copyright has always been envisioned as ultimately for the benefit of the public, as is everything that Congress does, in fact. You know, there's a lot of discussion in some of the Supreme Court cases that says, you know, by giving authors money, what we're doing essentially is benefiting the public. I mean, the authors are sort of the recipients of the largesse, but the public is the ultimate beneficiary of that. So in a way, I think it's a false dichotomy, because I think when authors benefit, when creativity benefits, the public benefits. And if authors benefit monetarily, that means that the culture that we have, I think your East St. Louis Tootaloo example that you played earlier on is a terrific demonstration of this. How many people in this country don't have access to that work because it's under copyright? They can buy it in a record store, they can hear it on the radio, they can go to the library and get the score. That work is out there, the public has access to it because there is copyright protection.
But they have to pay for that.
Well, they not in the library, they don't. Not listening to it on the radio, they don't. I mean, that is material that is in the common culture that people do, in fact, have access to. So by eliminating copyright protection, what you're going to get is a very, very marginal increase in the access that the public has to it. I think there's a much more serious issue about, you know, using that work as raw material to make a new work. You talked about the Gone with the Wind parody earlier. And I think that's a much more serious case, because copyright owners very often don't like to see their works travestied or parodied and will fight very hard to try to stop that from happening. But I think the law in the fair use area is really evolving toward a recognition of the, you know, the public benefit that comes from parodies and attacks and critiques of that sort. So I think even though copyright term may be getting longer, fair use is also getting broader, and that's going to take some of the pressure off in terms of the public benefit that we're supposedly being denied by the extension of the copyright term.
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Kathy's on the line now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I'm fortunate enough to work in a town full of songwriters and great publishers.
You sure do.
Some of the things that haven't been talked about, you know, we're talking about writers like the Gershwins and people like that have had tremendous success. But they are the minority, and there are so many struggling writers that the only thing that keeps them going is thinking that they might at some point in their lives get paid for some of the work they create. Otherwise, they live on very small advances from publishers. And, you know, I know of an instance right now, I mean, just because you create a work does not mean you're going to be getting income. Sometimes a song sits for 10 years before it finds the right place. I know of a song right now that just has been sitting in a catalog for 10 years and it's just been recorded. Well, that's 10 years into that copyright where there was nothing. So, you know, in that sense, the writer is kind of been robbed of that time of his copyright. And then, you know, the jazz musician who called in and talked about how he just can't afford to pay to record songs. I don't think the public is aware that the statutory rate for recording a song is 8 cents per copy. And if it's a collaborative work, so there's 8 cents that gets paid on each song from the record company.
Kathy, would you argue for copyright in perpetuity then?
I would, because I think these people who create this work have a right to leave something to their heirs on down the line, just as anyone working in any kind of job in the world has a right to create something to leave to their family from the work that they do in their lifetime,
right,
and not have someone cut it off at a certain time.
Now, that actually isn't what the Supreme Court is going to decide, but the Supreme Court is going to decide sometime over the next year whether or not the copyright extension, the extensions
right.
that have been added on, are constitutional. Let me, if I can, Kathy, thank you for the voice there on behalf of the artist, and ask Robert Clarida and Edward Lee to wrap this up for us. What are we expecting to hear from the Supreme Court on this? If it's not copyright in perpetuity, how are they going to figure this out? Bob, do you want to start?
Well, my best guess would be that they're going to leave the law as it is. It's not often that the Supreme Court, even this Supreme Court, strikes down an act of Congress as unconstitutional, and I don't think that's going to happen in this case. I haven't seen, and granted, I'm on one side of the issue. I'm mm-hmm. hardly a neutral observer here, but I haven't seen a really compelling knockdown argument that says this has gone too far. I do see some things that the justices are alarmed about and concerned about, but I think probably what will happen is that they will say this term extension was okay, term extension in general is okay, but they might put out a marker someplace and say when it gets beyond a certain point, probably not put a finite number on it, but they very well may make some cautionary remarks that there must be a limit someplace, but we haven't reached it yet.
Edward, I guess you're looking for something more than that.
Yeah, Dick, but I know my limitations, and I'm not in the business of actually making a prediction about what the court will do. I think the court is taking the issue very seriously, and I just wanted to say that the type of concern that we should have extends larger than this case. I think that the last two callers who called in for perpetual copyright shows why the rest of us in the public should be concerned that if you give Congress the ability to keep on extending, there will be a lobby to actually get extensions down the road. So the work that we thought would be in the public domain in the year 2018 might not be in the public domain until 2048, let's say, down the road. So this is a debate that's going to take place not just with the Supreme Court's decision and the Eldred case, but continuously as we try to protect the public domain.
Edward Lee, just a quick last word from you, though, on the idea of fair use, that all that music and all that literature is there anyway.
But the fair use standard, actually, I would disagree with Bob's point that it's an expanded in the past few years. It's actually a standard that leaves very little ability to the person trying to make a fair use ahead of time to know what exactly is a fair use. You have to be ready to fight that battle in court, and many people may not be ready to do that for good reason.
Edward, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Dick.
Edward,
it was a pleasure.
Lee, Professor of Law at Ohio State University College of Law. Robert Clarida, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Robert is partner at Cowan, Leibowitz & Lattman in New York. They were there arguing the two different sides of the copyright term extension. And it'll be a year or so before we actually get our answer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is